Welcome one and all to the world's only podcast, the only podcast in the world, brought to you each month from the AOS 21 Podcast Network, hosted on Podomatic. And now for our commentators, Ian Roberts and Joshua Silberman.
So, yeah, we're back. It's been a hot minute, hasn't it?
It's been, hold on, let everyone pause while I do the math of how many minutes are in 2 months.
don't bother. But I can tell you for me, and I know my wife would argue about this with me, it's definitely been a long 2 months.
What do you got going on? You haven't had anything happen, right?
No, other than becoming a father at the very beginning of November.
Holy shit! Oh, I knew that, though. Congrats and condolences, man. That is fantastic. How's that going? I'm glad you're here and you seem kind of awake.
So I think my wife had the best quote regarding his one-month birthday on December 1st. She said it was the shortest and longest month of our lives. And I'm wondering if you felt the same way about your daughter.
There's a phrase, you probably heard it, the days are long and the months are short.
I think the nights are really what's long.
You said the nights are long?
Yeah.
It's all kind of, every day feels like a month, and every month feels like a day. That's what it is. You'll turn around and your kid is like two.
Okay. And we'll actually talk a little bit about that later. But before we begin, we do have a, I guess, unfortunate announcement. Ian and I have come to the mutual decision that it's time to hang up the headphones.
Yeah, it's there's a lot going on. You know, Sylvie has a kid now, and that's for my part, I'm feeling kind of burned out. And I might be projecting on this, Sylvie. I feel like a lot of people are kind of feeling that right now. I don't know if your kid has rejuvenated you, or if maybe it's also now there's this other thing you're paying attention to. But it's been getting hard, I feel like, and I want to hang this up before we really, A, before we start to resent doing this, and B, before the product gets crappy.
So we've made the mutual decision that besides this episode, we'll finish out the year. But then unfortunately, it's time to hang up. But we promise to do one last send off before we go. In the meantime, we still have an episode to get to this month. So Ian, you ready to rock?
I never have been and never will be. Let's go.
Best we can hope for. All right. This month, we're talking inflation. At the time of this writing, inflation is kicked into high gear. And what necessarily do I mean by high gear? What I generally mean is a so-called core inflation rate, I always have trouble with that word, above 4%. At last measure, the core inflation rate going from October 2020 to October 2021, which is the last major barometer we have, was roughly 6%. Now, these numbers may sound low, but people are feeling it. People are feeling it at the grocery store. People are feeling it at the gas pump. And in my mind, outside of racial and social justice issues, nothing can derail a political campaign more than the concept that your money isn't worth what you think it should be. As some people, I feel, have gone in different directions in terms of inflation's being overstated, inflation's being used as a cudgel. I will start this segment by saying that inflation right now is nowhere near what it was in the 1970s. We're not at the nightmare scenario. And inflation is not nearly as bad as some of the hyperinflation we're seeing in mismanaged economies such as Venezuela. But that being said, we have gone through, what do you think it was, Ian, about maybe 10, 15 years of almost like 0% or 1% or 2% inflation? And now we're jumping to 6. Does that sound right to you?
That schedule sounds about right. Is it right? Is it in terms of adjust? Well, it seems like maybe it was due. Is that what you're saying?
That's kind of part of what's the reason I wanted to talk about this segment. You know, we went on for years at this low inflation rate, and when it comes to inflation and politics, one of the biggest arguing points for the minority party, the party that's not in power, is that the spending by the majority is going to trigger massive inflation. But for two presidential administrations, both of which ran in the red, and the Republicans definitely more than the Democrats, actually, no, three at this point, it hasn't happened. We never saw inflation really creep up until COVID came along and broke the primary supply chains.
It was COVID. You know, we dumped a bunch of cash into the economy, which was the right call. I actually would have done more than was done, but that has the nasty side effect of spiking prices.
Well, that alone isn't what did it. I would argue it was more the supply chain shocks and not being ready to people have things to spend that money on. And so the supply side, I think, in my mind, is really what triggered it. But that's a debate for another day.
Well, and Corey, I talked a little about the supply shortage last month, which, you know, he and I kind of thought would end on its own. It's not clear to me that this will end on its own. I think that's kind of what, certainly what the White House is hoping at this point. It's difficult because obviously here in December, things look kind of bad. It's impossible to know what things are going to look like October, November next year. So it's easy to overreact to this kind of thing. You had sent me a link to the view from the ivory tower, as you put it. I rolled my eyes when you said that, but I opened the link and saw that it was written by Paul Krugman. So you were right to scoff. But it's worth examining what he says there, if only to predict where he might be wrong. He compares the inflation spike to the one we had right after World War II, which was caused largely by a huge spike in consumer spending. They couldn't buy a lot of goods during the war. For example, they couldn't buy white onions, just the big yellow ones. So Americans were then making up for it because they could now buy a lot of goods again. So, and it got worse because we did a lot to try to correct something that didn't need correction. We ended up in a recession. So that later got balanced out by a lot of infrastructure investment, especially the Highway Act, which is where we come back to the Biden administration with the Build Back Better program. Is they're at least hoping is an attempt to correct things a little bit. The question is, will they overcorrect?
And again, this is where it gets to be such a political hot potato. Now, obviously, the ivory tower argument, I know you hate it when I use that phrase, is that the president cannot control inflation. But I do believe the president can control perceptions of inflation, or at the very least, try to be a little more, not emotive, like sympathetic about it, maybe. Part of the reason I say this is that I felt the narrative from both the White House and Democrats in Congress has truly shifted momentously over the course of the summer till now on inflation. It started with, it's not that big of a deal. It's going to go away on its own. Oh, okay, maybe now it is a big deal. And between this and, again, talking about some of the social justice issues I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, I feel like the Democrats have pretty much written the GOP's attack playbook for 2022.
Part of the trouble here is that pretty much everything that Democrats want Biden to do, certainly most of the things that I want him to do, the things that he was elected to do, tend to result in more cash being pumped to the economy. For example, stimulus payments, super popular. I mean, maybe ignore economics, maybe ignore policy. It's good politics if people like it. But those payments would exacerbate the problem at least a little bit. Student loan debt forgiveness, same thing. Most any action Biden takes runs the risk. Again, economists disagree on this, and we can talk about how, you know, the soft science of economics. But most any action he takes has the risk of exacerbating the problem. So it's do your agenda and take some risks, or do nothing and hope the economy improves. You obviously go with the former choice there, just to try to do something.
And this is where I have to admit, I really do feel for the Democrats in this case, because when they finally get the political will together to do something momentous, to really, really spend money on things that, well, let's say this government, Democrat and Republican, has spent money repeatedly and over the red line and have gone into deficits before. But this is really the first time we've seen Democrats plan to spend money for things that we really need, e.g. infrastructure, social safety. And what happens? Inflation starts to take the air out of the tires, almost literally in some cases. And I really feel for the Democrats on that one, because we have gone, as I think you and I said, 15 to 20 years at low inflation. It got to the point where I started believing in that the people advocating for something called new monetary policy, which is the idea that you can run deficits forever without negative consequences, might have been right. Because every time somebody said something about inflation from 2000 to about 2018, nothing happened. And I started thinking maybe this is indeed a lot of crap. So, you know, I feel for the Democrats on that one.
I've started to wonder about this. I've seen some point to this as being media overhype, and I think that's a little bit true. That doesn't mean it's not real. Inflation is happening. You pointed to some of the numbers already, and we'll post some more statistics in the show notes. But people feel it. But, you know, for one thing, despite a lot of economic indicators still being pretty good, people are feeling chronic economic anxiety. And so any news story that says economy bad, and it kind of spirals. Can I offer a super amateur take on this?
I mean, what else do we do here?
That's right. I believe it is in our job description. So over the last year and a half, maybe especially last year, consumer spending did go up. And some of that is because people got money via the stimulus. But a lot of it is because buying things gave people a sense of control during a time when they felt powerless. So retail therapy? Prices go up. And then the media puts out stories about inflation being this enormous beast that will devour us all. So people do more retail therapy, continuing to drive prices up. So it becomes not a self-inflicted wound. What is the phrase? Just a spiral that we can't get out of because everyone is so exhausted.
But this is the first time we've seen that spiral in almost two decades. Again, you have to go back to the supply chain side of the equation, or the supply side of the equation, which I really feel a lot of Democrats on the whole ignore when it comes to arguing about economics, which is, you know, again, put the pandemic aside for a moment. If the pandemic had happened, but the supply chains, the actual logistics of shipping and just-in-time weren't disrupted, retail therapy would still work, and it wouldn't have nearly the same effect on inflation as it is now. I mean, the reason it's getting so bad isn't just because we have all this money to spend, it's because we don't have a lot of things to spend it on, versus previous times we were overproducing in many respects. Think of how fast the fashion industry collapsed.
Maybe I'm just lack the imagination to separate the supply chain shortages from the pandemic. They are intertwined to a large
degree. Yes, yes. I mean, they are intertwined. But what I'm trying to get at is this is the first time we've truly seen the supply chain side interrupted on a global scale. People have always talked for years about how it was kind of teetering, but nothing ever seemed to knock it off. I mean, we've had a nuclear disaster in Japan that didn't knock it off balance. And yet this finally did.
I'd also argue that the pandemic is a bigger deal than Fukushima was.
But that was off the top of my head, that was the biggest deal I could think of in a major distribution hub, e.g. Asia.
And it's one of those things, this is why it's so hard to predict what's going to happen, because we're only, you kind of need time and perspective to see what kind of happened here. This is why economics is a soft science. All the social sciences are, but because you can only really observe passively, you can't do a proper experiment, you can't do a control group. Experimenting on whole populations is generally frowned upon. So, and then in the aftermath of a thing, you know, say inflation continues or maybe even deflation kicks in, they'll say, economists will say, well, of course it went that way. It was always going to happen that way. We knew that. That makes sense. So it's impossible to get a sense in the moment of how things are going to go. And that's the risk for the Democrats. That's why I go back to my point about, you might as well just try to push your agenda through and see what happens. 2022 is going to be a bad year for you almost no matter what.
Right. So the question obviously is, how do you mitigate that? I will also add to this discussion that it's important to remember who inflation hurts the most. Like everything else, inflation tends to hurt people at the lowest end of the pay scale spectrum the most. And I do have an article here that talks about how I think the lowest 40% of earners are feeling the most in terms of inflation that we're of the four to, I'm sorry, the 6% inflation that we're seeing. And I want to pay a point to some of the pay increases we've seen over the past year, that the pandemic has finally given people at the lower end of the pay scale to demand. Now, I'm not blaming pay increases for inflation. There's a whole other slew of issues for it. But what I do want to point out is that this level of inflation, again, bad for the Democrats, seems to have negated all of those pay raises. So that's why they're feeling this the most. I think there was an article out there, and I didn't want to post it because it was too stupid, but it was almost a candy slogan for the GOP. It said, you know, inflation's here to stay. It's going to happen. Lower your expectations. Go out to eat less. Try to stay home more. I'm reading this and I'm thinking to myself, you know,
to interrupt. The Republicans are now telling people to stay home more.
No, this wasn't the Republicans. I'm saying this was an opinion piece I read in the Washington Post, but it almost read like a poster letter for. It was basically back in the time when Democrats were trying to argue that inflation wasn't so bad. Okay. But you should just, you know, accept what it is. It's going to stay here. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is just a slap in the face to poor people.
I mean, with Omicron, you should probably be staying home more anyway. Separate topic, though. The Build Back Better program has other benefits that are more important. I think a lot of economists would have that pop up in the sources that we'll post say that, too. You know, fighting climate change, expanding access to healthcare. You go ahead and take those risks. My worry is that Democrats have no stomach for risk. A Republican administration would just go ahead and do it
if they wanted to. I mean, they wouldn't do something like this because it's not in their MO. For my part, I've generally been a fiscal conservative most of my life, but even I have to recognize when the overall infrastructure of a place or a country has been ignored for decades, and we desperately need that investment to stay competitive in what I have dubbed the new Cold War. So I'm all for Build Back Better. And I actually disagree with how much it's been slashed. I actually think it does need more in there. And I really believe that if the administration or business or whoever can ungum some of the supply chain disruptions, it will negate some of the inflation that we're seeing simply because it will bring the supply side more into line with the demand side.
Do we want to move to our closing arguments?
I think we have to at this point. Okay. Are people going to fall asleep?
Yeah. So have you ever seen that episode of The Twilight Zone where the small child has terrible godlike powers and uses them just in the capricious way that a small child would use them? That's what I feel like the economy is. Like there's nothing we can do about it. And sometimes it just decides to blink us into a cornfield for no good reason. So we just try to be good around it.
Mm.
This sucks.
I don't entirely buy that because I do think there are things we can do on a macro level. I mean, I devoted my life to the study of information technology and its impact on the world. Granted, I'm one of those people who made the major mistake of thinking that more information would lead to better results. And boy, was I wrong about that.
We all made that mistake.
Yeah, but I think I was one of those people who really believed in the idea of more transparency. I mean, I also believed in the idea of this type of information leading to a democratic China, so take my view of it as you will. But I don't buy that we can't do anything. I would say that, like everything else, it takes management by a competent government and a government that's willing to admit when there is a problem. And as you said, the Democrats have no stomach for risk right now. And unless they do something to either admit that there's a problem or find a way to magically gum up some of the supply chain issues so people can spend this money again, the GOP is going to have their playbook written for 2022.
Ready to move on?
At this point, absolutely.
This episode is sponsored by...
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/AOS21. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
In November, two long-standing murder trials came to an end. Both began with incidents from last summer's long race reckoning. Both ignited cultural firestorms, but they had very different endings. In Wisconsin, Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of all charges, including the shooting and killing of two men and wounding of a third in the aftermath of protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The trial itself became a source of outrage. You had, on one side, an inept prosecution trying to prove an unprovable homicide charge. On the other side, you had cringy court theatrics from an 18-year-old defendant. But he was acquitted, and because this case had enormous cultural and political meaning, the right celebrated it and the left decried a broken justice system. A few days later in Georgia, three men were found guilty on murder charges in the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery. Now, on the show, we covered this before. Sylvie and Corey talked about this in the spring of 2020. The murder itself had actually happened the previous February. It took a long time for the charges to get brought, and we'll talk more about that. But the Arbery case and the reaction to its conclusion was a lot quieter than the Rittenhouse case. I had even forgotten it was happening until the day that the verdict was announced. In fact, the case might not have happened at all had, again, the defendants not videotaped part of the encounter and then released the video, believing it exonerated them. Despite the video being out there again, it took 2.5 months for charges to be brought, which I think is a crime in its own right. Now, it's worth examining a couple of things. One, what do these trials have in common? But also, why were they treated so differently in the public imagination? Let's start with the Rittenhouse verdict, because that's a really tricky one. I wasn't surprised by the verdict, and I contend that most people weren't surprised. A lot of people were upset, but that's not really the same thing as being shocked and appalled. Sylvie, what was your reaction to that verdict, and why, in your mind, do you think the Rittenhouse trial had so much more of our attention?
I think because a lot of people wanted to see a guilty verdict for him, but they couldn't justify it, even with the cases that were made. I mean, I was just floored, not just by the argument itself. Already we knew, based on the early evidence presented, that a homicide charge was going to be difficult to stick under not just a self-defense law, but just, I guess, just an account of the events that actually happened here. But I was just floored with how badly the prosecution managed this case. I mean, they called witnesses that essentially helped the defense. They withheld evidence. They changed statements midway through. I mean, wow, it was just like they were almost trying to get this thing thrown out. So
For one thing, you need to know what your witness is going to say before you ask the question. Like, I'm not a fancy big city lawyer or even a small town lawyer. I'm actually not allowed in most courtrooms, to be honest. But I know that you can't fly blind like that. And then second, the prosecution's witnesses made Rittenhouse look so much better. Some of the things they describe sound like out of a movie.
Based on that alone, if we're looking at actual evidence presented in a court of law, he should look better. This is what happened. This is what he did. And I think a lot of people are having trouble reconciling that.
I was talking with a family member at Thanksgiving who kind of understood that, you know, there wasn't really a case here, but there has to be something you could charge him with. Like, for example, acting stupid, which I argue you don't want a law that does that, partially because the Kyle Rittenhouses of the world aren't going to be brought up on that acting stupid law. It's going to be people like Ahmaud Arbery. are going to be brought up on it. You don't really want that. And I understand, you kind of alluded to this, the frustration that something should have happened here. And I tried to look, again, not a lawyer, tried to look through Wisconsin law to be like, okay, what would fit here? I looked at maybe vigilantism, but you know, I think that would require the police to say that he interfered in their operations and the police are not going to testify against this guy.
And he didn't, as far as I can tell, he didn't. There weren't any police there. I mean, there were police that he approached later and before, but in the actual incidents, as far as I understand, they weren't there.
And then I thought reckless endangerment, but you know, Wisconsin does not have a standard ground law, but they also don't have a duty to retreat law, which just feeds back to the self-defense argument, which is pretty easy for Rittenhouse to make in this case. There was really nothing that could be.
And I kind of feel like that's where this the crux of this is. Now, the actual charges came a week. Most people don't remember this, but they came a week after the cop that shot. The officer that shot Blake was acquitted. Now, that happened very quietly, and he's not going to face any punishment outside of maybe some time off. But that happened extremely quietly, but it did have an extremely angry reaction. And when that happened, I think a lot of pressure was put on the district attorney to put something on Rittenhouse beyond the illegal possession of a weapon charge, which is what they were going to go for initially. Maybe that would have stuck, maybe it wouldn't have, but it definitely had a better chance than homicide. Now, when the acquittal of the cop happened, suddenly there's major political pressure on the prosecution to do something. They overreached and the defense just ran with it. Now, I'm sorry, but if I'm in really any type of court situation, I would want my defense to do what the defense here did, which is take advantage of the mistakes of the other side.
Yeah, that's what they're supposed to do. The defense was run well, the prosecution was not, in part because, like you say, that bar of trying to prove homicide was so high. I also thought about the illegal weapons charge. I think that would have been dodgy as well.
It would have been dodgy, but it would have made a lot more sense, and in my mind, I think it would have had a better chance of standing up.
Basically, our perspective on Rittenhouse is that people are frustrated that kind of always knew that this felt predetermined in a way.
And I would argue they're frustrated that they don't have an argument to make against this kid. I mean, as you said, argue for him being stupid, but they can't argue that he actually broke the law based on what we saw in the courtroom.
Yeah. So let's compare and contrast to the Arbery case, which got less coverage. And I kind of think that's because it was more clear cut, no?
Do you think that's why it got less coverage? I think because it's more clear. Well, yeah, maybe exactly what you said. Maybe because we knew what these guys did, there isn't as much debate. There isn't this consecration of, you know, where justice lies. We know what happened, but the fact that it didn't get as much coverage, I kind of think speaks of the volumes of where coverage of race is in this country. I just feel like I said a lot of words that meant nothing. Sorry.
Welcome to the World's Only Podcast. I mean, I kind of see where you're going with it. It's looking at it, common themes of the two, race is not really one. For one thing, I believe that the Arbery trial, the jury was all white, so that didn't really come into play.
It was 11 white, one black.
Okay, so, and then I admit I was also one of the people who thought the people that Rittenhouse shot were black. They were white. Everyone involved in that situation was white. It happened during protests/riots that had racial origins. Yes, but that's not the same thing. So race doesn't come in that case. It obviously is the crux of the Arbery case. And you had that video that came out as well, which I've gone back and forth. Because I've heard some people say that the killers thought that the video would exonerate them. And I kind of feel like the killing of Arbery was really more of a lynching.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
And part of what lynchings do is not just kill one person. It's also to send a message. And I think the video was supposed to be that message.
Whether consciously or subconsciously, I absolutely agree with you. That video was meant to send a message. In terms of the actual trial itself, you said that race was the crux of this. Now, in terms of popular opinion, yes, I agree with you. But I did find it interesting that the prosecution opted not to make race a part of this, or at least a primary part of their prosecution. They might have mentioned it once or twice, but they really stuck to what the persecutors did. And the actual murdering of Arbery. They didn't necessarily...
I mean, you have 11 white jurors. I would also not lean too much on the race bit of it.
I'm not arguing with their strategy. I actually think it was a good strategy.
Yeah. When I say race to the crux of it, I mean he was killed because he was a black dude jogging in a neighborhood where three people didn't want him jogging.
No, absolutely. But I think I've noticed that, and maybe this is because it didn't get a lot of coverage on this either. A lot of people were angry that the prosecution didn't bring up race. And I think to be angry that she didn't do that ignores the realities of the trial itself, ignores the realities of jury management. And frankly, it throws out this idea that you want a certain outcome to further your cause versus a moral victory. And that in of itself is a terrible motive for the social justice movement entirely.
So aside from these cases happening about the same time, can we get any common themes between the two?
I mean, the biggest theme I've got here is media coverage and reaction between the two. As we said, one was clear cut.
But those two things have been different in each case.
Right. But that's what we're studying the most of here in terms of like what overlap there is between them, besides the fact that they had, some sort of racial overtone. Rittenhouse does have a racial overtone, whether you want to admit it or not. I think one was painted on there. I don't think there's anything necessarily in common between the two. They happened on almost opposite sides of the country. One involved people of different races. The other did not. One involved basically two opposite sides here, a prosecution and a defense that were really on their game and took advantage of the mistakes of the other side, which, again, is what you want to happen in a court of law. I think the biggest thing I walk away from is sort of shaking my head at again, I hate using the term social justice warriors, but like people who really advocate for this idea of anti-racism, really shaking their head at the Rittenhouse trial and saying the system's broken, because everything that you would want to happen in a courtroom happened in the courtroom. It happened fairly, happened above board. And you don't let lawyers get away with mistakes like that. You just don't.
You've almost said my closing thought for me. And it's essentially that our justice system is deeply flawed. It's not quite broken, but it's not strong either. However, I don't think either of these cases proves that the system is broken, except maybe in how long it took charges to be brought in the Arbery case.
And that's policing. That's not even the justice. That's not even the court system itself. That's policing. So
it took a while, but justice is kind of being served there. So between these two cases, you had three extrajudicial killings committed by people who had no business doing what they're doing, being where they were. What's broken here is kind of our culture, I think. It's not something that the legal system can fix. Unfortunately,
yeah.
I know people wanted to, and I get that. I'm frustrated too. But if I were to point out another common theme here, the only one I can think of is the sense that guns can solve any problem. And I've become more convinced in the last 5 or so years that America's problem isn't guns; it's kind of our attitude toward them. And that attitude means either one chunk of the country refuses to learn about them, and then another chunk of the country that treats guns as something between like a religious totem and a sexual fetish. Our culture is kind of what's broken here. The legal system, for all its flaws, was not the bad guy in these cases.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a very good closing thought. And it makes me think of this idea of the legal system may not be able to fix our problems, but it can definitely tweak them. I mean, we already saw changes being made to Georgia's self-defense law, citizens arrest law, that was used as the defense for the defense team. We've already seen a Republican governor signal that that's going to be struck down. So changes can be made. As you said, it's our system is deeply flawed. But I do think in these two instances, it worked. And maybe it worked because a lot of people were paying attention, but it did work. And so with that, I would say take the cases for what they are. Don't put too much into the Rittenhouse case, because if you do, again, you're only going to write the GOP's playbook some more.
Is our next topic happier?
A little bit, actually. It's about a pending environmental disaster.
Oh, come on.
But not in the type you think.
This episode is sponsored by...
So I'm looking for some Expos merch, but all I'm seeing are old Andre Dawson jerseys. Do you know where I can find some more recent stuff?
Well, I don't know who, what, or where the Expos are, but I can tell you that you can now pick up Washington Nationals gear from our friends over at Fanatics. Just head over to AOS21.com/theworldsonlypodcast and click on the banner at the top of our page to get great deals on World Championship Washington Nationals merchandise today.
Hey, wow, Fanatics actually has Expo stuff. This is a great site.
I'm not sure if you've seen this down in Maryland. Up here in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, parts of the Northeast, we have seen an invasion from Asia. And I'm not talking racial overtones here. I'm actually talking about a real bug. It's called the spotted lanternfly. And up close, it kind of looks like a larger ladybug. And they actually look,
it's
almost
pretty.
A little cute. Yeah, I actually think they're kind of cute. Yeah. But apparently, they're a pending environmental disaster. First of all, they're considered an invasive species. Second of all, they breed like rabbits. And apparently they can do moderate damage to ecosystems around here, so much so that states have begun actions to quarantine trucks going to and from certain areas that require them to be sprayed down with pesticide before they move on to their destination, just because they're afraid of these things spreading. Now, what made me want to talk about this is I saw something that I've never seen in my lifetime, which is a mandate by the state. I am asked as a citizen of New Jersey that if I see one of these things, I'm to document that where I saw it and then kill the thing, to stomp it, to crush it, to get rid of it in any way possible. If I see its eggs, which come in sort of a gelatinous mass, I'm supposed to kill them. If I see them in clusters, I need to report it immediately to the sanitation department of my local town. Like, I have never seen, even in I live in a state that mandated deer hunting because of overpopulation of deer. And I've never seen a campaign like this before.
The reporting, I think, makes sense. I think with a lot of infestations, that's always been a thing. It's the permission to squash them is, it's, I mean,
just permission, encouragement, it's basically everything short of an order.
Encouragement. And that's kind of the rule that you follow generally. It's the opposite of the rule you follow generally. If they're in your house, kill them. If they're outside, you leave them alone. They're not bothering anyone. Encouraging them to squish them it's really funny because it's got to be the most New Jersey solution I've thought of. It's so perfect. Like, it almost makes me think that you all just made up the problem and first of all, blamed it on Philadelphia. Like you say, because that's where it came in through Berks County, Pennsylvania, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you just, I feel like New Jersey was just stomping on bugs, and then Delaware looked at you and said, what are you doing? And he said, the bugs are all over. They're Chinese. And then Philadelphia brought them in. And now they're on the gabagool crop, so we're stomping them. It's really funny. But seriously, this actually could be a problem. You know, because it's not a direct threat to humans, really. But they do go for plants, especially trees. They attack fruit crops. They attack hops and grapes. So that's beer and wine under threat.
This means war.
Yeah. That's now you have me stomping on them. But the thing is, if you've ever had a bug infestation, you know that killing them when you see them doesn't solve the problem. There are a whole lot more you're not seeing. And these things have only been here for, was it about 7 years? Like, they came here in 2014?
They came here in 2014, but they really started to spread in 2019. Like, we didn't see them in the numbers we've seen them until this year. And I'm not sure what changed it. I'm not sure if it was an increase in shipping from China. I'm not sure if it was a change in breeding cycle. It could have been climate change for all I know.
I think all of the above are probably the answer. It's also just they had to get here, and then they reproduce very well, but it takes a little bit of time for that to really happen. And actually, 7 years isn't that long. That's pretty fast. And yeah. I did see that a couple years ago, the USDA did import wasps from China to combat this, but they're still saying what those wasps would do to our ecosystem. Like, you asked why China or Vietnam, where these things live, don't have this problem. The fly is okay in its own ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly. They have natural predators. I mean, think of it like the murder hornets we saw. I can't believe I'm going back to the damn murder hornets.
Oh, I remember the murder hornets. Whatever happened to those?
Well, I think we finally trained the bees to fight them.
And that's what you do. So, like, with wasps is one idea, but then you're stuck with wasps. And maybe for the wasps, you get, like, giant spiders, like radioactive spiders. And then, but then you have to get green goblins to fight the Spider-Men. Then we're stuck with symbiotes all winter. Okay, yeah. You see why this is a problem. You see why there's no good solution.
You know, speaking of solutions that really don't work, I actually did see something that came out of Bucks County as an interesting solution, that in areas where the spotted lanternflies are congregating to lay their eggs, people are putting out fly paper all over the trees that they hang out on, and they're killing them by the hundreds.
Okay.
And it's both beautiful and disgusting to look at the exact same time. I did want to add two things here. First, I did want to ask, have you seen them down by you?
So they've been sighted. I've not seen them in person. They've been sighted here in Montgomery County, but we are not under infestation yet. But infestations have been noted in a few neighboring counties. In fact, I was in such a county for Thanksgiving, but that county was not under quarantine yet.
And I did want to mention that the speed at which I've seen them has significantly slowed down since October. I feel like since the weather's turned colder, I don't know if these things hibernate or whatnot. I'm not sure if they go into a different type of part of their reproductive cycle. I definitely haven't seen them nearly as much in the past month as I did during the late summer months. So I don't know if that means our squashing campaign has been successful. I don't know if this is a triumph of the tracksuits, but I do know they're either lying in wait or we're making progress. Either scenario is terrifying.
You kind of have to wait until basically next summer to see, right? That's part of why this sucks, is in the meantime, you're waiting to see if, okay, their numbers are even greater than they were before. Do we just unleash the wasps now? It could just be a natural low. It's winter. They're dying off, or they're, you know, it's either going to get much worse or it's going to get better. We know that.
Yeah, I was thinking back to the squashing campaign, and so we have a roof patio in our building. And so, you know, during her pregnancy, my wife and I would hang out there sometimes and we'd see the spotted lantern flies and I would squish them because that's, as a good American and a good New Jerseyan, that is my job now. And she would be disgusted by it. Respectful.
Had the encouragement to squashing begun at that point?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It started, I want to say it officially started in August.
All right, then she needs to get with the program.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, yeah. What type of unpatriotic foreigner is she? And she'll smack me when she listens to that later.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, we haven't seen them. But back over the summer, we had the cicadas, the Brood X cicadas. I'm going to post a link with more information. But this particular breed shows up in a similar area to what the lanternflies are currently doing. So it's basically D.C. up to central Pennsylvania and then over to Philly. They show up every 17 years. They're big, loud, they're ugly. They kill young trees. They kill the saplings. And at the end of the summer, they leave millions of corpses all over. It's disgusting. I think I talked a little about them at the beginning of an episode a few months back. You know, the ones that go on trying to find a mate even after losing their abdomen, those things. Mm-hmm. The key difference, though, is that the cicada is a native species. They're a natural part of our ecosystem. They show up every 17 years. We know they're coming. And they only do damage to, you know, small trees, young trees.
And they provide a lot of food for a local bird population. So that's when the birds fatten themselves up. So again the circle of life here.
Again, the ecosystem. They're mostly just annoying. Now, if you dealt with all of that, if you remember the cicadas, imagine that plus the valuable agricultural products, we would be stomping on them too.
I can't help but wonder. Now, as we said, there's no natural predator of the spotted lanternfly here. I can't help but wonder if birds have tried to eat them, if they're poisonous. I'm not sure what the deal is with them. I'm guessing that if they have New Jerseyans trying to stomp them, there isn't a natural predator for them.
We are the natural predator.
Well, it's not natural. I had to be told to stomp them. That's not natural.
That's fair. Yeah. So yeah, I don't. It seems like it doesn't, or it wouldn't have these huge numbers in just 7 years if there were a natural predator here.
No, they're definitely a type of ecological menace. I'm not quite sure of the logistics of how a so-called quarantine is enforced. I mean, I know I've gone from county to county that's supposedly been under quarantine and haven't been stopped anywhere. As far as I know, these things are not on my car. I wash my car pretty frequently. You know, who the hell knows what that does? I have not seen, again, I've gone from seeing them almost daily to not seeing them at all, which makes me wonder maybe if they are dying out here, if they have managed to lay their eggs. I haven't seen any of the egg masses on the types of trees that are around here that they supposedly inhabited. So I'm thinking maybe we've made progress. Maybe we'll get them back down to those 2014 levels, but who knows?
Yeah. I'm looking at a picture of the life cycle of the spotted lanternfly. It's much less cute in its other phases.
Nope. I mean, it's one of those weird things where the adult is actually, you know, cuter than the kid. I mean, even the cicadas can't say that.
Yeah. Kind of like butterflies in that way, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we should wrap up here. We don't talk about ecological stuff here very much. Like it's fun as a change for us to do this, but we need to keep in mind it's going to be a bigger deal over the next few decades. Like these flies have nothing to do with climate change, maybe a little bit, but that's all ecological stuff too. Animals and crops will die. The animals that don't die will migrate to areas they normally don't inhabit, and that has ecological consequences. We can contain the spotted fly problem. I think we probably will, but larger scale problems are coming, the kind that we can't just stomp on.
Yeah. And, you know, granted, we will try. That is the New Jersey way. We will try to stomp on it. I mean, it didn't work with Philadelphia, but we still tried.
This episode is sponsored by...
Hello, listeners. If you like the World's Only Podcast, then you'll love our merchandise, right, Ian?
I guarantee.
Head on over to tpublic.com/AOS21. That's AOIS21 for all the latest and greatest in World's Only merchandise. Also, check out the merchandise of other AOS21 podcasts as well.
I guarantee. In October, a former Facebook data engineer named Francis Haugen handed over documents to the Securities and Exchange Commission in advance of her testimony before Congress. Those documents were reviewed by the Washington Post, which obtained additional documents and conducted interviews with dozens of current and former Facebook employees. The so-called Facebook papers, as the Post called them, provide, quote, an unprecedented view into how executives of the social media giant weigh trade-offs between public safety and their own bottom line. Among other discoveries, Instagram triggers body image and self-esteem issues in teenagers, especially teenage girls. Facebook, which has stepped up efforts to counter misinformation in advance of the 2020 election, dropped those efforts as Stop the Steal groups proliferated and only started banning those groups once the January 6th insurrection was underway. And it's much worse at policing content outside of North America, where for many countries, Facebook is the internet. Facebook fomented hatred that helped fuel the genocide in Myanmar that has so far killed some 20,000 Muslims. It consistently, quote, chooses engagement over safety, and we will get back to that point. Now, we're not going to cover all of these in great detail because there's no time. There are hours-long podcasts delving into the papers, and I recommend reading the post's whole analysis. But the takeaway here is that Facebook was aware of all of this. This information came from their internal findings. They put more resources into growth than into security. And before Haugen could testify, Facebook systems were knocked out for almost 6 hours because of, quote, a cascade of errors. But I think it was pretty convenient timing. Eventually, Haugen did testify. Some politicians have committed to breaking up the internet giant. Now, Haugen, for her part, didn't seem to think that would be terribly effective. But Silby, we can't live like this. If there were a drug with the kind of impact Facebook has had, Congress would have outlawed it already. But a $1 billion multinational corporation is harder to tackle than a drug, isn't it?
Opioids, anybody?
Crap. Okay, we're re-recording the entire intro.
All right, so that aside, obviously there's a lot to unpack here, and it comes all back to the discussion we've had for a long time, which is what responsibilities does a platform have to police the content on it? And this goes beyond the scope of free speech here, because free speech only goes to the government. No one is regulating what is said on Facebook. I think what we're trying to regulate is how it's said or how it might be navigated. You're right. What we're doing right now is unsustainable, but I also wonder what in our current ecosystem can necessarily be done about it that doesn't trigger even a legal backlash. I mean, we could try to make the antitrust case. I don't think it would fly very far because, you know, you can still argue that even with the outage we had, Facebook in of itself is not a commodity you need to live. Yes, it would be extraordinarily inconvenient, but are we at the point where we're arguing that it is essentially a public utility?
I mean, I argue the internet is, are we saying Facebook is?
But the internet didn't go down in that attack before the testimony. I mean, all of Facebook services, WhatsApp, Instagram, I forget whatever else thing, the Oculus that nobody uses, those did go down. You know, I went on my working day. In fact, if anything, I was probably a little more productive that day. Now, this isn't to say that that didn't have drastic consequences. I know I've read that a lot of people lost business because they primarily do the majority of their business, their advertising, what have you, on Facebook. So, yes, there is an argument to be made that it might be a public good. But for me, we can talk about the evils of a social media giant. I question how much responsibility does a platform have to police its own content? And if it does, can it do so consistently, which I don't think it can?
I mean, that's what in the post story that sort of Facebook employee said, we have no commercial or moral incentive to do anything other than give a maximum number of people as much of a positive experience as possible.
Which sounds like a standard business line.
Yeah, commercial certainly. Moral, I'm not so sure about that. But then the positive experience bit, I mean, how positive is this experience? And this comes back to the idea of engagement over safety, because Facebook is arguably the worst at it, but this is how the internet writ large operates. No, one thing I can't get over here is how the human brain is drawn to conflict and negative emotion. Like, Facebook didn't invent that. I feel like news media has known that for a long time. But Facebook didn't give additional weight to the angry react because they thought it would be funny. Just for reference, an angry react is worth about 5 times what a like is worth in Facebook's algorithm. I think they eventually set the weight back. But basically, the angry react led to more misinformation, more disturbing content, more graphic violence in some cases. They didn't do that because they thought it would be funny. They did it because it makes people stay on the site and look at things. And they have data to back that up.
Which, again, is the point of a business. Use our product as much as possible.
Yeah. And personal responsibility does come into play. You do need to log off and go touch grass, as the kids say. But Facebook is knowingly exploiting human weakness. This is tobacco company.
There are a lot of companies out there that exploit either a need or a known weakness. I mean, a tobacco company exploited addictiveness. But does that necessarily... But we also know that actual use of tobacco is bodily harmful that can't be recovered from. I mean, as you said, you can log off Facebook.
You're right and you're wrong. I don't think that neuroscience fully understands, at least not yet. I don't think they fully understand what social media does to our brains. I think we're only just beginning to realize that. And once it's there, I think it will be at the tobacco level. How could you not know this was bad for you? Because for a long time, the public didn't know that either.
And I guess, again, I'm arguing. So what we're arguing here is not, again, we have to reiterate, we're not arguing the free speech aspect. We're not arguing what people can say. We're talking about maybe how that content is delivered. And we should note that even if Facebook is broken up, there's going to be somebody out there, maybe not at the same scope or scale, but there's going to be somebody out there that's going to deliver this type of, what did you call it? Hate-like? What was the term you used? Angry reaction?
Yeah, the angry react. The literal angry react on the
frowny face is what they're arguing? Oh, wow.
That's not my argument, is that they gave more weight to that than they did to the like. You were more likely to see something with a lot of angry reacts than you were something with a lot of likes.
Now that I think about the news, not the news feed, but the news section of Facebook, NEWS, I actually do agree with that, because I do see things that tend to get a lot of angry reacts. Yeah. Versus just straight out like, oh, this is what happened in the local government today. You know, these parking meters are out.
You can see the smaller scale, too. I think if someone just has a post about something happened their day, and there are a lot of angry reacts, like they you know, something bad happened to them and they post that, that gets to the top of my feed a lot faster than something that just had a lot of likes. Like, I had a nice day today. And more people see it, so that causes more comments to happen. Like, I'm sorry that happened. And so it just pushes higher. It pushes the garbage to the top.
It constitutes a danger to our democracy. Facebook did what a company is supposed to do, which is push profit over it, because they're not necessarily regulated to police it. I mean, what happens now? I mean, what necessarily would regulation look like, assuming that they aren't broken up? And even if they are broken up, I mean, Facebook is still going to be Facebook. They'll just have less data. They might be slower at what they do, but they'll still do it.
That's effectively what Haugen said. She said in her testimony that because these systems are going to continue to exist and will be dangerous even if broken up, they would probably go smaller, maybe a little more. We talked a little bit in the past about some of these, the more extremist platforms going a little more underground and being harder to track. I think that might be part of it.
But that was in the entail of law enforcement. I mean, I'm generally not a fan of out of sight, out of mind. But at the same time, you know, there's a huge difference between Parler, which I'm not on and I don't see at all outside of out of the news, and Facebook, which is literally everywhere.
Is it easier to track if it's one big thing that is?
Yes. From a system standpoint, if you know one data source, one stream, then from a system standpoint, yes.
We can know what it's doing, essentially. You do make a component of how, because that's what Haugen said. It's called for more regulatory oversight, which Facebook has continued to resist. Now, I don't know if you've seen the ads they put out about how they want more internet oversight. Like, they're at least publicly, they're campaigning for the government to do more of that, which frankly does need to be done. It's been a while since we have, but it seems to be just, Facebook is very good at throwing attention elsewhere. That's why I do think, call me conspiracy theorist, I think that outage for 6 hours was them just trying to distract from the testimony.
You know, I have to admit, the more and more I look at that outage, the more I have to agree with you. The fundamental consensus among cybersecurity experts is that it was not an attack. Is that if it was indeed an accident, it was an internal accident. But the reason your conspiracy theory has some teeth is because from a system point of view, we have something called single point of failure. And in this instance, it means that you do not run Facebook, WhatsApp, Oculus, and whatever the services are on a single server. You spread them out so that if one fails Facebook, all your other services are still intact. They didn't do that. And I find it hard to believe that a company of Facebook size and scope would either A, not have the resources, or B, not have the know-how to do that. So, yeah, I think you might have a point to make there.
And it's the both the micro level of, you know, triggering eating disorders in teenagers to the macro level of fomenting hatred for other people. It's some of this is how much were our brains designed to interact with all of the world at once, which they weren't.
Which sucks on a human scale if you really think about it, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, if anything, Facebook disproved my idea that I mentioned in an earlier segment, in an earlier show, that more information and more knowledge of each other would be a good thing. Instead, it's led to information overload, and now we all need to retreat to our corners and think about what we've done.
No, that's exactly right. I think we weren't designed to do this. It's a little bit sad that we can't, we can all join in the brotherhood of man this way, but the brain wasn't designed for that. It's hard. Like, it's hard to log off. Like, you know, I want to tell people to get off Facebook, but until I manage to do that myself, I can't in good conscience just say do it. I've been better at not logging in. I uninstalled the app. I didn't log in for several weeks, and it wasn't until there was a series of deaths in my family and in my social circle that had to sort of bring me back. And that's what Facebook does, right? It worms its way in and makes it hard to divorce from. It can be done. I know people have done it.
And it's a damn good communication tool. I mean, when my son was born, Facebook and WhatsApp were how we communicated with my relatives in Israel and vice versa. I mean, we are probably closer to them. I feel more comfortable, in a sense, telling them on WhatsApp a week before I might go, hey, I'm going to Israel. When are you guys free? I mean, that was the most positive version of what Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram were supposed to do.
I mean, not that long ago in human history, you would have had to mail pictures of your son to those relatives.
What's mail? It's a non-electronic version. I know. All right. Any closing thoughts you want to wrap up? But actually, I'm going to start with closing thoughts because you wrapped up last time. I'm going to go back to I can't remember her name. Haugen?
Haugen. I'm sorry if I've been pronouncing her name wrong.
Yeah, and I apologize if I do too. I do agree that breaking them up is the wrong move. I think breaking them up sets a dangerous precedent for how large a company might get. I mean, we could have another discussion about competitiveness and the idea of of companies gobbling up each other. There may be regulation about how data is handled. I think personally, better data privacy laws would slow the algorithms down. But I don't know if we can necessarily regulate how especially how Facebook acts in other countries. I mean, if Myanmar isn't going to regulate how Facebook runs their business there, you know, what jurisdiction do we as Americans have to regulate them? I do think some form of regulation has to come in. I really don't have any idea what it looks like. For my part, I have really shut off a lot of the political news that comes its way on my feed. I mean, the things I post are just things that I see on mainstream newspapers. I don't really dive into the, you know, smaller bits of Facebook and the net anymore. And I really do try to stick to things like, you know, arguing sports with my friends. I'm part of several Facebook baseball groups. And even more, and this is, again, you know, what social media was supposed to do. I am part of a local dad's group that dispenses advice to new fathers, and same for my wife and mothers. So I don't necessarily want to lose that.
It is mentally taxing to filter out a lot of it, but it's something you kind of have to do. But on a whole scale, when actions have happened because of Facebook, when things are happening across the world because of Facebook, Facebook also needs to take some responsibility and shut it down. You say that a business doesn't have to. Well, does it have to be a private business? And that scares a lot of people. And I don't know how you do it, but we can't keep living like this. Like, so the solution is obvious. Destroy the internet.
Oh, if only. You know, if you destroy the internet, it probably makes the world a better place because it separates all of us again. But it also puts me out of business.
I would still have a job, but my job's going to be so different. Just go back to early 90s technology, fax machines and high-top sneakers for everyone.
I'm starting to think that the early 90s might have been the height of human technology.
I've started thinking that more myself. Yeah, like at most, maybe go like late 90s.
Right before, would you say right before smartphones?
Yeah, I would say like late 90s, early 2000s internet.
And devices like that where, you know, I really had to work my thumbs in order to get a message out there. Because then it made me really think about what words I wanted more and how much I wanted to work out my thumbs.
Yeah, you had to pay for each character.
Oh, yeah, remember?
I don't remember what the rate was, but yeah, you had to be real careful.
Maybe that was the turning point of humanity when text messaging became unlimited.
As is always the case, the world was better when you were 16.
All right, want to move on?
Let's go.
This episode is sponsored by...
Hi, Worlds Only listeners, Ian here. Are you craving more Worlds Only content? I got some good news. If you become an AS21 patron, that's exactly what you'll get. See, we usually give you 4 new segments every episode, but we actually record 5 segments. That's right, that's 1 segment a month you're not getting for free, but you can if you join at patreon.com/AS21. By becoming a patron, you'll get our 5th segment, plus more podcast content from AS21, like Publish Me and Passion on the Page, so much great stuff. So if you're jonesing for more Worlds Only and AS21 content, go to patreon.com/AS21. Isn't that right, Silby?
That's right, you love our voices, so now love them even more.
So we thought we'd end this particular show with a discussion back and forth about fatherhood. And the reason we're talking about that is Ian and I now have something in common that we didn't when the show started, which is we are both fathers. Refresh my memory, Ian. How old is your daughter?
She's 3.5.
All right. And my son is now 1 month old. And it's obviously, you know, a very new experience for me. To say it's a slap in the face is doesn't do it justice. I mean, it was a gut punch. And I say this in the nicest way possible, in a way that hopefully won't piss off my wife, because, you know, she would admit the beginning months have been hard too. And I kind of want to hear from you, because I am talking to all my friends who are fathers about, you know, what those first weeks and months were like and how you adapted from kind of the person you were to the person you are. And I know it's a bit of a loaded question, but, you know, I think it's something that I, as a new father, and probably new fathers around the world, need to hear right now.
A lot of blackout for that first few months. Just the
what
lack
do you
of
blackout. Sleep. Like you don't want to remember, or you don't remember.
I wish I could remember more. I wish I could have appreciated more at the time. I don't know if it's a first kid thing, whereas everything's like, oh, what's happening now? She has a fever. What do we do? Whereas, you know, the second or third kid, you don't have that so much. I think as you get experience, but the lack of sleep is also part of it. Like you hear a lot about that, but that's not a joke. Like there's a reason that sleep deprivation is used as a torture technique. It's really bad. So you were telling me before the show started that you actually slept pretty well last night. It sounds like he's doing well with that at least.
It's getting a little better, but I also admit I have an unfair advantage in that, you know, I'm not responsible for all of his feedings. I mean, my wife is the one who has to pump, has to produce the food, so she has to get up more. I also have a slight advantage in that right now I'm back to work. We'll switch once my wife's maternity leave ends in early February. I will go on a round of paternity leave.
How long did you take initially?
I took 3 weeks when he was in. So I should back up and say that Jersey again, thankfully, being a somewhat more progressive state, does have a relatively good family leave law that allows 8 weeks unsequential for or uncontinuous for me to take as a new parent. So I took 3 weeks when my son was first born, and I'll take the additional 5 after Rena's maternity leave ends.
Yeah, that's similar to what we did. I took a month off, basically using all my sick leave, and my wife took 3 months, again, using all her sick leave, because, you know, pretty good benefits in that regard. And then when she went back to work, I spent 2 more weeks back, and then our daughter went to daycare. So, yeah, that trade-off is, and so you're back to work now, and that's rough in a lot of ways unto itself. I remember I would get home after I came back, and, you know, I'm tired from working, and obviously my wife's tired from taking care of a small baby. And it's tough because it's kind of now it's second shift for both of us. The way we usually did it was she would get up and then make dinner and I would take care of the child, but we're both tired and both of us felt bad that the other was still doing things. But that's just what it looks like. That's just the reality of things. Something I do lament a little bit is, you probably heard the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child, something like that. Mm-hmm. There was a time not that long ago, and we'll talk about how pandemic has made this very different, but even pre-pandemic, we kind of gotten away from that as a culture. Not that many generations ago, it was more communal way of raising children. You were raised by, you know, other family members, maybe other members of the community. Also, like if the mother was tired of holding the child, she hands it off to another, just someone else, and she goes and takes a nap or something. Now, your wife can do that, just hand it off to you. Well, she goes to take a rest. You've probably heard the phrase, when the baby, or you've heard the advice, when the baby sleeps, you sleep.
Oh God, you know, I've learned to hate that.
I do too. The phrase is well meant. The advice is well meant, but it ignores the fact that you have your own lives to live. Like you probably noticed, the house gets really dirty when you're saying you have a kid all day, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's wild how that happens. So you have to take care of that. Your relationship with each other is still important. You have to do that. That's really hard right now. There are other things you have to do. You're going to work. Like, you can't always sleep.
I should bookend that a little bit. And this might be, you know, I hate putting a silver lining on what amounts to a terrible disaster for the world, but the pandemic has had a silver lining for me personally. First, professionally, it really was a boon for my industry. You know, it really gave me good employment because cybersecurity became a huge thing. And that work from home aspect also meant that when I did go back to work, I am working from home. So I am here to relieve a little of the pressure, say, on my lunch break. So that is one advantage I have. And I have to state that up front, that it is somewhat unfair to make that comparison.
One other thing. Does your boss or your immediate supervisor, do they have kids?
Yeah. And he's been very, very, very understanding.
That helps so much, right? Especially, I think, if your boss is a father, kind of like, because there's a lot of thing with fathers like, oh, well, your wife can take care of that. And that sucks for everyone, that attitude. Like, no, it's not just on her. Like, I don't need to tell you this. I know you know this. When you're taking care of your kid, you're not babysitting. But people still use that phrase when a father's taking care of his kid. No, this is my child. This is me doing my job.
No, and I do need to give a shout out to my boss, to the culture at my company, InfoAxis. In fact, even before I had a child, they've had a very, very flexible culture, at least with me. Anyone that they can allow it for, they've allowed to work from home pretty regularly. My boss has always had an attitude of, you know, here's what I need done, when I need it done, how you get it done is up to you. So I give him a...
Yeah, it's really great in my job, you know, partially because a lot of the higher ups also have their own kids. But if, you know, my coworkers with slightly older kids, oh, they're sick, I got to go right now and go get them. Especially during the pandemic when whole classrooms shut down because someone else was sick.
Again, something else I didn't have to deal with. I mean, maybe I'll have to deal with it in the future. I mean, I've got family members who are dealing with their own kids who are still dealing with that.
Well, when we're on the Omega variant in 3 years, yeah, you'll kind of know where I am.
You know what I'm not looking forward to? When we have to go to the way fraternities and sororities do this is when you get to the end of single digits, you go double-double. So it's the alpha-alpha variant. And then alpha-beta, and then alpha-kappa.
Don't put that idea in the universe. What are you doing? Stop.
What, did they,
Stop
they think they were going to be done at Omega?
All right. And yeah, so yeah, and it's... So it's good that he's at least kind of sleeping. You'll get to the sleep regressions at some point. That's a whole other thing, which kind of brings me to my other point about phases. Think about back to your own life, especially before you turned like 20, like those years you went through phases and then the phase ended and it was completely gone. By the time you're used to whatever phase your kid is in, he will move to the next one. It's because right now he's in what's called the fourth trimester. You probably know that term, where he just kind of lies there. He's a potato that screams.
Yes, exactly. He's attracted to light. I've noticed that too.
Oh yeah, that doesn't go away. My kid is super stoked about Christmas lights all the time. and I think that's a human thing too. You're just attracted to shiny things because shiny things, I think, represent fresh water supplies. I think is where that comes from.
So we think it's a survival instinct. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, right?
This has been today's useless fact.
Useless and then fact in quotation marks. I don't know if that's actually correct. at this stage right now, it is very easy parenting. And you're not going to hear that because I know it's really hard. But you can also just sit with the kid on the couch and just watch something. And because the kid's not taking anything in, you can watch really violent TV. You can watch HBO at its most exploitative. It's fine. The kid's not taking anything in. And that's, I wish we enjoyed that more, but it's hard, certainly with the first kid, that you don't know what's, you know, how it works. And it's very unrewarding. That's the hard part because the kid's not smiling.
It definitely scares me a little bit. I mean, I don't mind sitting there with the kid, but it scares me this idea that this is the easy part because this seems really, really hard right now. And it's only going to get harder.
But you will get more experience. That's what's going to happen. It's like getting promotions at work. Like it's the same deal. You will get there. I will say just enjoy the part where you can sit with him on the couch. Enjoy the part where when you put him down somewhere, he stays there because that goes away. But it's also hard because it also gets more rewarding. It's like anything else. The more effort you put in, the more rewarding it is. Right now, he's not smiling. He's not laughing. And one day he will. And that's gonna be like, and that's a lightning bolt when that happens.
He had this moment. I will say he had this moment. So because of his length and the way he started holding his neck when he was not even a day old, like maybe for brief seconds, but because of that, the doctor recommended that we do short sessions of tummy time.
Wow, that's real early, yeah.
This kid managed to flip himself from front to back twice in the month he's been alive.
Wow, that's insane. I mean, good and bad. Like,
yeah. Everybody's
doing that. But like, my daughter was behind in a lot of her physical skills. It was the only reason we weren't real worried is because of her emotional until her emotional skills seemed to be there and everything else. But so yeah, you'll probably be out of that phase sooner than we were, sooner than a lot of other people were, which comes with its own benefits and drawbacks. Like I said, the part where you put them down, they stay there, that's going to be over for you earlier than most.
Mm-hmm.
But appreciate that you're not the part where you have to instill, like, no, we can't eat another breakfast. No, you can't get like, we're coming up on Christmas right now. And come December 26th, we have to say, no, you don't get that again. You don't get it till next year. And yeah. So it's the most, probably the most draining where you are right now, because the lack of sleep is a huge part of it.
That's probably the biggest thing for me. I have been a person who thrives on routine, and all of that was blown up. And I have,
buddy, that's all over routine.
That's been the hardest part for me.
Eventually you'll get a new routine, and that just be prepared for that routine to get shifted every few weeks, months. It's real hard. Like I think some friends of ours, they have a kid, I guess, probably now 7 or 8, but a couple of years ago, we were talking to them, and she gets herself up on Saturday morning and makes cereal and gets herself some cereal and watches cartoons while we stay in bed, and we want that so bad. So it's just a matter of, you just have to get there. You'll get there, you'll get through this part, and then the kid will be doing some other thing that you're not ready for.
Yeah, before I know it, I'll be up watching baseball games with them, and maybe they'll actually be paying attention to the screen.
Yeah, I thought my daughter seemed to like it for a while, but now she says, baseball, that's daddy's favorite. But then she then wants to watch Paw Patrol. She doesn't want to have the baseball on.
That's what the iPad is for while she's watching Paw Patrol.
Yeah, precisely. So yeah, now we're at the part where we got to watch, like, be mindful of screen time. It's one of those, again, that I mentioned, the complications that come in. It gets really,
yeah. I mean, back when we were kids, I'm sure there was things that they had that parents had to watch out for too, things that they should have been watching out for. Nowadays it is screen time. I don't want my kid to be zombified, but I also want him to be used to technology in the way that I am.
And it's wild how quickly they get good at searching. Like my daughter has her own iPad that we only give her, you know, if she's done something right. And she can, for someone who can't read or write, she can search for the content very well. but then I've also seen the zombified effects. Like I try to get her attention. I call her name and she's still just staring at the thing. And that's terrifying when they do that. It's, oh no, what have I done?
So we got to wrap up this segment. And, you know, thank you for regaling me with your stories, because I think the more of these stories I hear, the better prepared I personally feel. And, you know, hopefully I'll get to do that for friends of mine one day, or family members who, you know, and who enter this phase. As I said, I think of everything we talked about, I am a little worried about the idea that this is the easiest part. As you said, it gets more rewarding. You know, we'll see what happens when my kid learns to walk, for example, which may happen sooner than later. I will say I have one small advantage in that my wife is teaching him to speak Hebrew, so maybe I won't be able to talk with him earlier. I joke. We're not concerned about that.
I mean, young kids can take that in better.
Exactly. And that was something I wish that was done for me more, because I only speak one language, and my wife would say, I barely speak one language. If my kid can speak two or three like my wife does, I'll take it.
I'm glad you have some points of reference for this already. Typically, the way these interactions go is you're giving advice to someone for whom the kid is not born yet. So they're coming in cold with that information. But you've probably seen experienced parents exchange notes like, oh, so you potty trained them by letting her go bottomless for a while. We tried that and it didn't work for us. You already have some perspective. And, you know, so it's easy to get some info. It's been easy for me to gauge like where you are. So it's that helps a lot, because, you know, every kid is different. You know, it's only when you see how you're doing with your kid and then you see what other parents do with their kids, that's when you really start to learn it better. And I'll just say, like, I've seen photos you're posting on Facebook. Those have been great. You know, you're clearly enjoying it as much as is possible, given, you know, everything else. Like, it is hard. I don't want you to be too bummed out about, oh, it's going to get harder. Some parts get easier, some parts get harder, but it also gets more rewarding. Your kid will start doing cute things. I picked her up from daycare some months back, maybe a couple months ago, and she points at another kid. That's Lucas. He's my friend. And she points up in the sky. That's a bird. It's not my friend. Just a bird.
See, it even sounds like you.
I mean, that's my voice. And it just the huge slam on the bird out of nowhere. So you get those moments. Those are like, I said, the lightning bolt. Okay, that keeps you going. And you don't have those right now because it's just the potato.
I mean, yes, it's just the potato, but I've also seen the way that other people, my family members especially, and, you know, without getting into too much detail, you know, my family has been through a lot recently. So having this new joy brought into our lives, I've definitely seen my mother, especially how she's reacted to him. And that's been a blessing.
Is this the first grandkid for?
Yes.
Yep. That's huge. So good job on that. I'll say, like, you've got this, man. Like, thousands of generations of Silbies have come to this, and some of those generations would kill for the advantages that you have. So, like, this has been done billions of times. Teenagers do this.
No, if there's one feeling I've got, it's that I've got this. I'm not sure how, but I know in some way I've got this. So we do need to wrap up, but thank you for regaling me with these stories. Again, I think I feel definitely more prepared than ever. I hope we'll definitely keep exchanging those in the future.
Yeah, definitely. And congrats and condolences to you and your wife again.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of the World's Only Podcast, the only podcast in the world. Ian, where can people come commiserate with you?
Come commiserate with me at iRobertsLibrarian.
And I am at Sylvie_says. I don't post pictures of my kid on Twitter, but, you know, come give me congratulations anyway.
All right. Yeah. And yeah, we'll be back at you next month for, well,
I guess what's going to be our final show.
Yeah. Yeah. Bittersweet, guys. Enjoy this while you can, listeners.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the World's Only Podcast, a production of the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Hosted by Podomatic and available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play. Find us online at media.aos21.com. We'll see you all next month as the world keeps turning.
Copyright 2021. AS21 Media. The AS21 Podcast Network. Your voice, your story, your passion, our mission.